Welcome to Audio Notes. I'm David Finkel, Artistic Director of Music at Menlo, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce you to the music you'll be hearing at the festival this summer. For Music at Menlo's 13th season, we'll explore, with a more concentrated focus than in any previous summer, the life and work of one of history's most extraordinary musical figures, the Austrian composer Franz Schubert. In addition to ranking among history's most cherished musical voices, Schubert remains one of Western music's most fascinating and confounding figures. The only composer of the Viennese canon native to that city, Schubert represents a bridge from the classical era to the Romantic generation. Born in 1797, 12 years before the death of the father of the classical style, Joseph Haydn, Schubert lived but an ephemeral life. Beethoven, the composer whom he most revered, was 26 years his senior. Their deaths were separated by just 20 months. But what Schubert accomplished in his short life is astonishing. He enjoyed recognition in his lifetime for only a small part of his staggering output, the gradual revelation in the decades after his death of what he had done is unprecedented among the great composers. In addition to his epic contributions to the piano, chamber, and orchestral literature, his oeuvre of more than 600 lieder revolutionized the genre, transforming it into one of the Romantic era's essential art forms. And as illness forced him to confront his mortality before his 30th birthday, Schubert, who once claimed, "I have come into the world for no purpose but to compose," produced a stream of masterpieces unequaled by many composers over entire lifetimes. Nearly two centuries after his death, Schubert's place in the pantheon is secure, but his music continues unceasingly to offer new discoveries and immense rewards. Audio notes are designed to enhance your enjoyment and deepen your appreciation of the music you'll be hearing at the festival. I'll be joined by artistic co-director Wu Han, Audio Notes author and producer Patrick Castillo, and some of this season's festival artists to offer historical and cultural context and a variety of perspectives on this summer's concert programs. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to seeing you at the concerts.
Concert Program 6 pays tribute to an array of distinguished composers whose music connects to Schubert in powerful ways. Through lyricism, magical harmonies, drama, and above all, a reverence for the vocal line as the most human element of music. For both Felix Mendelssohn and Andre Previn, words were not even needed. And for Brahms, the addition of a singing viola part intensified the vocal experience. John Harbison's haunting evocation of Schubert's last days tells the poignant story of the composer 1 week from his death, seeking to improve his art by taking a counterpoint lesson. Tributes to Schubert by Fritz Kreisler and Franz Liszt lead to the Sublime Piano Quartet by Robert Schumann, the composer who wept the entire night upon hearing of Schubert's death.
Felix Mendelssohn's Lieder ohne Worte, or Songs Without Words, of which he composed 8 volumes comprising 6 songs apiece over his career, provide an essential snapshot of Romanticism. They are, first and foremost, a paean to the sovereignty of melody. They also reference, in an abstract way, the Romantic generation's preoccupation with poetry, as reflected in the Lieder of Schubert, Schumann, and others. Mendelssohn's Songs Without Words succeed in capturing the clarity and expressivity of sung texts, but they do so relying solely on musical character, without the aid of poetry. Mendelssohn biographer R. Larry Todd writes that the Songs Without Words, quote, broached in a different way the ability of music to convey extra-musical ideas, end quote. Indeed, Robert Schumann surmised that Mendelssohn originally composed them as songs with words and then withdrew the texts. Todd continues, quote, the new genre, which blurred the lines between the song and the character piece, later enjoyed great success and became synonymous with Mendelssohnism. End quote. Concert Program 6 begins with a set of three of Mendelssohn's Lieder ohne Worte, beginning with the very first, Opus 19, No. 1 in E major, composed in 1830. The song's enchanting melody has earned it the popular nickname, not bestowed by Mendelssohn, Sweet Remembrance. The third volume of Songs Without Words, Opus 53, was published in 1837. The third of this set, in G minor and marked presto agitato, demonstrates an entirely different character, exchanging tender lyricism for finger-twisting virtuosity and fiery Sturm und Drang. The set concludes with the eloquent Lied ohne Worte in E flat major, Opus 30, No. 1. The influence of Schubert on the entire 19th century Lieder tradition cannot be overstated. Indeed, it is Schubert who transformed the Lied into such a vital medium for Schumann, Brahms, Wolff, and myriad others. But beyond specifically placing the art song medium at the center of the Romantic repertoire, Schubert's Lieder provided the Romantic generation with a model of lyricism and expressive immediacy, as attested to by much of the era's instrumental music as well. Mendelssohn's Songs Without Words, simply put, are unthinkable without the Lieder of Schubert. The next work on Concert Program 6 even further attests to the far-reaching influence of Schubert's songs. The German-American pianist, composer, and conductor André Previn ranks among the most revered musicians of his generation. Born in Berlin in 1929, Previn left Germany in 1938, traveling first to Paris and then settling in Los Angeles in 1940. He began his musical career orchestrating Hollywood film scores, which, as was common practice, he was expected to conduct himself. Subsequent conducting engagements eventually led to a prestigious international career, including posts as music director of the London Symphony Orchestra, Los Angeles Philharmonic, Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, and others. Alongside his activities in the realm of classical music, Previn has also toured and recorded extensively as a jazz pianist. He is equally renowned as a composer of music for the concert hall, where the rich lyricism of his musical language has won over audiences worldwide. Previn composed his vocal Lieds for soprano, cello, and piano with Schubertian speed. The work was completed in one day, July 18, 1995, at the Tanglewood Music Festival for Sylvia McNair and Yo-Yo Ma. At 6 o'clock a.m. the following morning, McNair, Ma, and Previn recorded the work in Tanglewood's Ozawa Hall. Previn's deeply affecting vocalises demonstrates the enduring tradition of romantic lyricism in our own time. As with Mendelssohn's Lieder ohne Worte, the vocalises can trace its lineage back to the Lieder of Schubert. Also, like Mendelssohn, Previn forgoes words, allowing pure melody to speak for itself. After the death of Robert Schumann in 1856, Brahms emerged as the standard-bearer of the Romantic vocal tradition. But like Schumann before him, who carried on Schubert's legacy in his own deeply personal way, so did Brahms infuse the Lied with an essence entirely his own. Brahms composed his two songs, Opus 91, for alto, viola, and piano, over a period of 20 years, between 1864 and 1884. They were intended for the violinist Josef Joachim and his wife, the singer Amelie Weiss. The set comprises one secular song, Gestillte Sehnsucht, or Stilled Desire, and one sacred, Geistliches Wiegenlied, Sacred Lullaby. The earlier Geistliches Wiegenlied was designed as a gift to the Joachims in 1864 as they were expecting their first child. It begins with the viola intoning the hymn tune Josef lieber, lieber mein, Joseph, my dear Joseph, setting the context of the Virgin Mary singing to the baby Jesus. A gentle rocking to and fro sustains the accompaniment throughout the setting, evoking a tender lullaby. The Opus 91 songs were published in the reverse order of composition. Brahms composed the first of the songs, Gestillte Sehnsucht, 20 years after Geistliches Wiegenlied. Josef and Amelie Joachim had at this time recently separated, and Brahms composed the song in the hopes of helping the couple to reconcile. The song sets a text by the German romantic poet Friedrich Rückert.
Steeped in a golden evening glow, how solemnly the forests stand. In gentle voices the little birds breathe into the soft fluttering of evening breezes. What does the wind whisper and the little birds? They whisper the world into slumber.
Pianist Gilbert Kalisch.
The viola songs are unmistakably Brahms. Now, why are they unmistakably Brahms? That's a little harder to pinpoint. First of all, they're really not showy for the singer. It's a real piece of chamber music. It lies in a fairly low register. It's extremely gentle. The use of viola and mezzo give it a kind of melancholy and a lullaby kind of songs. In a way, I guess Schumann, Schubert would not, that's easy to say because they didn't, but they would not have written such a song somehow because it's more in the realm of a work of chamber music than it is of a kind of solo vehicle. Not that the Schumann or Schubert are showy, but these are particularly inward and particularly intimate, particularly without the quality of showing off the voice. I mean, they are dark-hued. I guess you can always speak, you know, that harmonically they sound like Brahms. But I think it's more the color of the piece that would set it aside.
The Opus 91 songs are unique in their orchestration and in Brahms's subsequent treatment of forces. The viola and alto voice timbres yield in a dark blend, exquisitely suited to Brahms's mode of expression. The viola line, moreover, surpasses a mere obbligato role, functioning as a dramatic equal of the singer. Given the earnest involvement of each part, the Opus 91 songs may be more legitimately regarded as among Brahms's chamber music than as part of his Lieder catalog. Citing his most important influences as the Bach cantatas, Stravinsky, and jazz, John Harbison's music is distinguished by its exceptional invention and deeply expressive range. He has written for every conceivable type of concert genre, ranging from the grand opera to the most intimate, pieces that embrace jazz along with the classical forms. His prolific, personal, and greatly admired music written for the voice encompasses a catalog of over 70 works, including opera, choral, voice with orchestra, and chamber and solo works. Harbison has written the following of his piano quartet, November 19, 1828.
This tombeau for Schubert was made possible by the generosity of Jim and Marina Harrison, at whose home near Geneva the piece was realized. Their library contained a book by Alfred Mann, Theory and Practice, in which an account of Schubert's lesson with Zechter and the lesson itself appear. The piece asserts Schubert's relevance to our present rather than any nostalgia for the past.
The quartet's first movement is subtitled Schubert Crosses into the Next World.
The trumpets of death are heard three times. Schubert begins his journey haunted by sounds which are not his music, but pertain to his music in disturbing ways.
The second movement is a five-part suite, subtitled Schubert Finds Himself in a Hall of Mirrors.
In the Hall of Mirrors, music sounds in a manner previously unknown to Schubert. Everything is played back immediately upside down. Thank you.
In the third movement, Harbison imagines Schubert recalling a rondo fragment from 1816.
Emblematic of a storehouse of ideas which are still to be explored, perhaps even in future times, the short fragment which begins this rondo is the only one in the piece composed by Schubert in his first life. Shortly before his death, Schubert went to the theorist Zechter to work on a very specific problem pertaining to the tonal answer of the fugue subject, important to Schubert in the composition of his masses. Zechter, well aware that he was teaching the most extraordinary student who ever came for a lesson, concluded by assigning Schubert a fugue subject on his own name. Schubert was unable to undertake the task. He died about a week later, on November 19th, 1828. Following John Harbison's poignant homage to Schubert, Concert Program 6 features two more literal tributes to the composer.
Born in Vienna in 1875, the violinist and composer Fritz Kreisler ranks among the most celebrated virtuosos of his generation. At the turn of the 20th century, successful appearances with the Vienna, Berlin, and London Philharmonic Orchestras catapulted Kreisler to international stardom. The New Grove Dictionary of Music and Musicians notes, quote, "Kreisler was unique. Without exertion, he practiced little. He achieved a seemingly effortless perfection," end quote. Kreisler was also an active composer. In addition to a string quartet, an operetta, and other works, his oeuvre includes miscellaneous pieces that he claimed had been written by various popular 18th century composers. Later, he admitted that these pieces were a hoax, and that he had written them himself. Some listeners got and appreciated the joke. Others angrily disapproved. But Kreisler was like, hey, you liked them before, the music's the same, so no reason not to like it now. The next work on Concert Program 6 is not one of Kreisler's pranks. It is a legitimate, honest-to-God transcription for violin and piano of ballet music from Schubert's incidental score to the play Rosamunde, the same score in which Schubert revisited some material for his string quartet in A minor. Kreisler's transcription, while naturally glorifying the violin, equally pays tribute to the irresistible melodic sensibility and disarming character of Schubert's musical language.
Alongside Kreisler's arrangement of the ballet music from Schubert's Rosamunde, the program offers a thrilling tribute to Schubert by the Hungarian pianist and composer Franz Liszt.
Franz Liszt was one of the defining figures of the Romantic era. Musicologist Alan Walker writes that Liszt, quote, "contained in his character more of the ideals and aspirations of the 19th century than any other major musician," end quote. Liszt became, in the latter half of the 19th century, the most influential composer of the progressive vanguard of Western music, known as the New German School, which included Richard Wagner and Hector Berlioz. He developed radical new methods of thematic development and boldly experimented with harmony and form. Among his most significant innovations was the development of the symphonic poem, an orchestral form that would become one of the late Romantic period's quintessential genres. Besides his activities as a composer, Liszt was also the most acclaimed piano virtuoso of his generation. Another of his most important contributions lies in his development of piano technique through his performance and pedagogy, as well as in his compositions for piano. Liszt transcribed Schubert's Die Forelle for solo piano in 1846. It's one of numerous transcriptions he made of Schubert's music, a significant tribute to an early Romantic master, from the composer who famously chided Johannes Brahms as a stuffy traditionalist. And, in fairness, Liszt's Schubert transcriptions are fairly liberal adaptations, unabashed glorifications of keyboard virtuosity. But, underpinning all the pyrotechnics, the spirit of Schubert's melodic gift still shines through.
While the extent of Schubert's artistic accomplishments went largely unrecognized during his lifetime, one contemporary who did recognize his genius was Robert Schumann. Schumann's admiration for Schubert runs so deep that upon the latter composer's death in 1828, the 18-year-old Schumann wept through the night. Concert Program 6, the component of this festival season that celebrates Schubert's legacy and influence among subsequent generations, concludes with Schumann's piano quartet in E-flat major, opus 47.
Schumann's compositions appear in clusters over the course of his creative career. The 1830s primarily saw the creation of piano works, and 1840 was his year of Lieder, followed by a year of symphonic music. In 1842 came Schumann's most significant chamber pieces. Between February and July of that year, he completed his three string quartets, each dedicated to Felix Mendelssohn. In the fall, he composed two companion pieces, first the piano quintet, opus 44, and then a month later the piano quartet, opus 47. Both were composed for Clara Schumann.
For me, it's very interesting that the piano quartet and piano quintet were written in the same year, yet they seem very different.
Violist Paul Neubauer.
The quintet seems very open and very easy to grasp, and the piano quartet somehow seems a little darker, a little more complicated, equally as stunning. I mean, to say one is better than the other is impossible, but there's more facets to the diamond in the piano quartet. There's more interesting things happening. There's more subtleties. There's more individual lines coming through, whereas in the piano quintet, there's a lot of orchestral sort of writing, unisons in the instruments, all the strings playing.
It's kind of like a piano concerto.
Right, you're playing a lot of the stuff together as sort of a group, like four instruments and then there's a piano. Whereas in the piano quartet, there's a lot of separate stuff. Of course, it all fits together perfectly. And there are, of course, places where the strings are all together playing certain motives, like, for instance, the beginning is this incredible mystery, perhaps, at the beginning. Like, what is going to be happening? What a strange thing. Oh, like, you play this long note and... It's like, what is going to happen? To me, whenever I play that, it has to be that way. It can never be like, okay, da 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 da. It has to be like, what? There's got to be wonderment. There's got to be questioning, like, where is this line going? And you can't play it like everyone's heard it in the audience. It has to be like, there's some people in there, maybe many people, who've never heard that opening, and it'd be like, ooh, that is out there. That opening slow part is just very, very strange. It doesn't seem strange to us if you know it very well, but it's actually, if you try to look at it as if it's the first time you're hearing it, it's just like really a little bizarre. You want to have that feeling of questions in it. And then all of a sudden, bum, 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 we're together. And that's where it's sort of similar to the piano quintet, yet it's just a little fragment. And then the piano, da 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 da, bum, 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 bum. That kind of writing is, I wouldn't say it's more fun to play, but it's more individual in the piano quartet than the quintet.
The third and final version of the theme begins in the cello. Here the music is marked espressivo. The second theme takes a more aggressive tone. After restating the slow introduction, Schumann launches into a fiery development section. Schumann continues to intensify this theme, and the development section ends with an impassioned utterance of romantic Sturm und Drang, before arriving triumphantly at the recapitulation. In addition to Clara Schumann, one of the 19th century's most gifted pianists, Robert Schumann had a particular cellist in mind when composing his piano quartet. This was the Count Matvey Wielhorsky, a talented amateur musician. Throughout the quartet, the cello plays a prominent role. The coda that ends the first movement features a new melody in the cello. Thank you.
the writing of the scherzo, there's the main theme. It's also sort of this mysterious that we all start to play together. Then we have these middle sections in that piece where lots of interesting things are happening. And then we have the third movement, which is like, I mean, we can't get better than the third movement of the piano quartet, starting with the glorious cello solo, and then the violin takes it, and then the viola has it later on. That tune, that melody that Schumann came up with is one of the top 10 melodies right there. I'll tell you my favorite part. When the cello plays the melody in the third movement, the second time the cello plays it, it's really, or it should be, really, really, really soft. And it's like we've all just played with our hearts soaring and the melody singing, and then all of a sudden, the cello should play like so inside. Like nothing. And to me, that hands down is the most one, the greatest moment of that piece is right there, when all of a sudden it goes inside and the cello is playing really soft.
Schumann uses a unique trick in this movement. As the viola plays the melody, he asks the cellist to detune his lowest string. At the end of the movement, the cello, whose lowest note is normally C, sits on a deep B-flat, while the rest of the quartet draws to a tender close. Listen to the warm and poignant effect this low note has on the music. Perhaps the most inspired moment of the entire work comes at the end of the slow movement. Schumann fashions a heavenly coda so transcendently beautiful as to transport the listener to another world. ¶¶ But inside this otherworldly music, Schumann sews a three-note motif, out of which springs the exuberant finale. The fourth movement lies on the opposite end of the spectrum of romantic extremes. Whereas the previous movement basically dwells on one slow theme, the finale bubbles with energy and erupts in theme after theme. After the poignant end of the slow movement, the music now responds with a boisterous note. It opens with a lively theme, which Schumann turns into a fugue. Following this fugue, the cello sings a sweet and fluid line. Next, the piano and viola engage in an animated dialogue. The music flows with magical ease and demonstrates a profound love of life, reminiscent of the works of Haydn and Mozart. With these basic musical ideas, Schumann spins a staggering finale to the piano quartet.
Then the last moment is, you know, you have the... You have that throughout the movement, and then it's being tossed around in different ways, but then at the coda, you have it come back, bom, 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 dee-dum, into this glorious coda at the end, and the guy knew how to write. What a great piece.
Audio Notes is authored and produced by Patrick Castillo and narrated by David Finkel, Wu Han, Patrick Castillo, and Rachel Sokolow. Additional mastering is provided by Dahong Situ. Musical excerpts on this disc appear courtesy of the following artists and organizations. Schubert's Piano Trio in E-flat Major is performed by Wu Han, Philip Setzer, and David Finkel. Schubert's Impromptus in F Minor and G-flat Major performed by Maria Joao Piresch, and Zeimirge Grüßt, performed by Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau and Gerald Moore, appear courtesy of Deutsche Grammophon. Isaac Albert Berg's The Sun Has Set is performed by Wolfgang Brunner and Werner Bient, and appears courtesy of Hofmusik. Mendelssohn's Lieder ohne Worte, performed by Livia Rev, and Franz Liszt's piano transcription of Schubert's Die Forelle, performed by Leslie Howard, appear courtesy of Hyperion Records. André Previn's Vocalise, performed by Barbara Bonney, André Previn, and Sato Knudsen, appears courtesy of Decca Records. Schubert's An die Musik, performed by Christopher Nomura and Derek Hahn, and C Major Fantasy, performed by Benjamin Bielman and Juho Pohanian. Brahms's two songs for alto, viola, and piano, performed by Sasha Cook, Paul Neubauer, and Gilbert Kalish. John Harbison's November 19, 1828, performed by Gilbert Kalish, Georgia Fusanis, Geraldine Walter, and Carter Bray, and Schumann's Piano Quartet, performed by Gilbert Kalish, Georgia Fusanis, Geraldine Walter, and David Finkel, appear courtesy of Music at Menlo Live. Audio Notes is a copyrighted production of Artist Led.